This is the Recent Interview with Nick Gillespie, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. On December 12th, voters in the United Kingdom head to the polls for a general snap election that will decide the fate of Brexit, the long-delayed British withdrawal from the European Union. To understand the stakes of the election, which will result in either the Conservative Party's Boris Johnson or Labour's Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister, I sat down with Daniel Hannan, a Conservative member of the European Union's Parliament, one of the leading architects of Brexit, and the author of books such as The New Road to Serfdom and Inventing Freedom, How the English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World. In a wide-ranging conversation, we talk about why British libertarians voted overwhelmingly in favor of Brexit, the urgency of honoring results of the 2016 referendum in which 52% of voters called for leave, and why Hannan believes a Jeremy Corbyn election as prime minister will set the UK on the path to a Venezuelan-style nightmare of neo-socialism.
Daniel Hannan, thanks for talking
with
Reason. It's
always a great pleasure to be with you, Nick.
So we've got a snap election coming up that will determine who controls Parliament, possibly the future of Brexit. This is just a few days away. Give me the libertarian defense for Brexit.
Free trade abroad and decentralization of power at home. Most UK libertarians, I would say 90 to 95%, voted leave. Now, that is not to say that the majority of the 17.4 million leave voters were libertarians, because we are a quite small chunk of the population in the UK, as here as everywhere. But I think the view was that the European Union had become self-serving, remote, cut off from the people it purported to speak for, and therefore, like all governments in that situation, bloated and expensive.
So why has Brexit proved impossible to implement so far? What's taking so long?
Simply that there was a majority in the House of Commons determined to thwart it. Since the 2017 election, so the referendum happened in June 2016, 12 months later there was a general election, Theresa May lost her parliamentary majority. So from that moment, there was a majority of MPs who were not going to let Brexit happen. In most cases, they didn't have the courage openly to vote just to cancel the whole thing and then go back and face their constituents. So they voted against every conceivable form that Brexit might have practically taken. They created this gridlock, this complete mess. And then they pointed at the mess and said, oh, look, this is all terrible. You know, maybe we should drop the whole idea. That was the tactic. But they, you know, people are not that dim. Everyone could see perfectly well what was going on. And so eventually there had to be a dissolution. It was clear to the country that Parliament was simply blocking Brexit. And the issue that is going to be decided, it's 1 week away as we record this interview, will be whether we get a government that has the majority to deliver.
And it is kind of stunning. I know people who are Brexit people or Leave people, whether on the right or the left, you had a referendum where research is correct, more people voted in favor of leaving the EU than have ever voted for anything in English history.
More than ever before. And everyone in advance of that referendum, especially the Remainers, said this is it. This is a once-in-a-lifetime vote. There's never going
to be Because they were confident that they would win.
Correct. Yeah. Right. And here we are. I mean, I have a little boy who is 3.5 years old. He has spent his entire life in a country that has voted to leave the European Union, but has not, in fact, left the European Union. So this is now way beyond Brexit. This is about the legitimacy and authority of our political institutions. If, despite all the promises they made, if MPs can't deliver on something as central as this, why on earth should people believe anything that any politician tells them? And that's what's now at stake.
How has the American media gotten the reasons behind Brexit wrong?
It really, extraordinarily so. I mean, I was expecting a certain misunderstanding or kind of results-driven analysis from some of the continental European media. I was stunned by the extent to which the Washington Post, particularly the New York Times, have invented this kind of complete fantasy, saying things that no Remain newspaper in Britain would dare get away with. You know, that the whole vote was angry, nostalgic, nativist, anti-immigrant. It was a kind of form of British Trumpism, but worse. And in parallel, this, you know, the casual reader of those titles would be forgiven for thinking that Britain is in an economic crisis, that we've all changed our minds, that there's a great sense of regret, that we're scrambling for foreign passports. In fact, we've boomed. We've outgrown the Eurozone. We've got record employment figures. We've got a record stock exchange. We've had more foreign investment than any country in the world except China. And the predictions that were made by the Remainers have turned out to be utterly, utterly wrong. And yet, this hasn't led to any modesty, any going back and questioning of principles. They've just stuck with their line of, you know, you're a bunch of xenophobes and all this.
Are there profound ways in which the EU, and, you know, this is slightly separate from the question of Brexit, but where the EU is a kind of triumph of liberal aspiration, so to create a free trade zone and a free movement zone within most of Europe, a continent that was killing each other, you know, 75 years ago?
Well, there is something called the European Free Trade Association, which is exactly that, which a number of whose members deserted and joined the European Union, including Britain. But the remaining members, Norway, Iceland, Switzerland, and Liechtenstein, are the richest and most successful and most contented countries in Europe because they have gone for free trade, for a common market, but not a common government. They've gone for that model of cooperation and, indeed, free movement of people as part of free trade, or at least free movement of workers. It doesn't carry all the rights to benefits and so on. But without political union, if that had been on the menu, there'd have been no referendum in Britain. There'd have been no argument in Britain. Why would anyone have been against that? The trouble was that the European Union aspired to become a state.
So you mentioned that Brexit and the election of Donald Trump get linked all the time, and you, people will also
partly
throw
just because of the coincidence of time.
Right, but
they were both
surprising. Why is it wrong, or are they analogous events, or are they really completely independent?
Well, I think the last time I spoke to you, they were very recent. We spoke in late 2016, and the last time I spoke to you on camera, I should say. And I remember saying then, look, there are some really important differences. For example, a big part of Trump's campaign, as far as I understand, was that, you know, he didn't want free trade. He particularly didn't want free trade with China. They were manipulating currencies and all this. Whereas a very big part of the Leave campaign, which we had in all our literature, was that we do want free trade, including with China. You know, and we're not getting it because the EU is protectionist and we can now be a much more global country. Our slogan, one of our slogans was Global Britain. We have this idea that outside the European Union, we can be a much more open economy, a much more competitive economy, and not least that we can have successful trade deals with friends and allies, including in the US. Now, it is true that if you are arguing against a long-established dispensation, you're going to be using some parallel arguments about the failure of existing elites. And that's inevitable whether you're arguing for Scottish independence or Brexit or Donald Trump or whatever. So there were therefore, of course, some parallels and similarities in terms of the presentation. But I think if the pro-Leave campaign had been the backward-looking, protectionist, anti-immigrant movement that Remainers painted as being, we wouldn't have got close to 50%.
You have spoken about the rise of what you call Bannonism and Bernieism. So it's Steve Bannon on the one hand, the former advisor to Trump, who's an unabashed nationalist, nativist, populist. Bernie Sanders, a populist on the progressive left. What do you mean by that phrase? And are they fueled by the same anxieties?
I think, you know, what the economic nationalists and the socialists have in common is, if you like, the elevation of the collective over the individual and the readiness to deploy state power for our own good, as they would see it. I'm struck, and I'm not sure which man will be more horrified by this parallel, but I'm struck by the similarities in tone, in many ways, between Jeremy Corbyn and Donald Trump, both in terms of what they say about, you know, building things in their own country and protecting the economy and standing up for workers and so on, but also in their approach to campaigning. The famous observation that the American voters took Trump seriously, but not literally. Corbyn is banking on something very similar. You know, he will come out with extraordinary, ridiculous, vast, exaggerated figures, not in the expectation that anyone's actually going to believe it, but in the expectation that he's kind of making a point that will resonate.
A specific example?
Well, I mean, that he's going to be increasing money for everybody. He's going to be giving more to students, to pensioners, to benefits claimants, to government workers. And all of this is going to be paid for by a small tax on the top 5%. Now, nobody actually believes that. I mean, even the Labour Party spokesman, when they're sort of giving the party line, you can tell they don't really
believe it. Do you think, does Corbyn believe that? Or
no, it's more that he's trying to make the point that we're on the side of the little guy
right.
by making a ridiculous claim. And in much the same, that when I say Trumpy in its form, it's a little bit like, you know, when Trump said crime is spiraling and we've got all these violent, I mean, that was not literally true. Crime was falling at the time he said that. But he was making the point that I take this issue more seriously than these other idiots, right? When he said we're being flooded with immigrants from Mexico and we've got to build this wall, I mean, 2015 was the first year that saw more Mexicans crossing south than north. But again, he was making the point that I at least am going to take this issue seriously. And I think Corbyn has learned from that. I don't know whether it's kind of fluke or tactical genius or some kind of idiot savant way of, but somehow in the modern age, because you've got this multiplicity of media, because you've got so many, if you like, alternative versions of the facts out there, it's much easier, whether you're a Trumpy or a Corbynite, to believe your version of facts,
right.
to find some statistic somewhere that will sustain the conclusion that you began with.
Let's talk about the resurgence of interest in socialism in the UK and in the US. Mm. How is socialism being defined in the current moment, especially by younger people? And what do you think explains its popularity?
Well, the one thing that socialists will never do is give an example of a successful socialist state. Mm. They can't, right? I mean, because it ends the same way every time. In Angola, in Benin, in Czechoslovakia, and it goes all the way down the alphabet, right? And when I say it ends the same way every time, I don't just mean it ends in poverty. I mean, it ends in labor camps and gulags and one-party control. So what people say is, yeah, but I'm not talking about, you know, North Korean or Russian or Cuban or Venezuelan. So I'm talking about this kind of abstract socialism that no one has yet tried. Mm-hmm. And you're therefore, I mean, of course you can win that argument. If you're judging socialism only as a textbook theory, but you're judging capitalism by its necessarily imperfect real-world outcomes, then of course you can win that argument, right? The trouble is, because a lot of young people have no memory of the real-world failures of actual socialism, they can only judge it as an abstract proposition rather than as an empirical reality. And so all of the old fallacies come back. And this, I think, is the reason why organizations like Reason and the Liberty Movement more widely are never going to go out of business. Every generation, like a moth to a flame, is going to be drawn back to the apparent verities, the apparently commonsensical assertions of socialism. You know, why have two factories producing exactly the same thing when the government can just reallocate one of them to a more socially productive end? You know, why allow the economy just to arrange itself higgledy-piggledy when, with a little bit of central direction, you could eliminate inefficiencies? You know, why allow only the profit motive to decide how the economy should be run when we have all this brain power that we could... Now, all of those things sound completely reasonable, right? They all, if you like, go with the grain of human nature. They chime with our inherited intuitions and instincts that served us very well as a species for a million years. It's just that they are all utter bullshit. And whenever they've been tried, it's ended up in poverty and tyranny.
Do you think part of the response to it, and I'm thinking of the coinage of, or the phrase Bannonism and Bernieism,
yeah,
which I think gets at something profound, as different as they might be in their particulars. Both Bannon and Bernie say, well, you know, contemporary capitalism, sure, you have cheap cell phones and a lot of TV,
yeah,
you know, cheap TVs, and you can play computer games, but you don't have any real meaning in
it's
your life.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And this is, well, except it's not extraordinary. It's a very natural thing, and every single generation has this alienation, let's call it that, this sense that there's something missing. We've become soulless, materialistic, and so on. There was one of those kind of Salafi nutters in the Middle East who came up with a fantastic phrase when he said, we want your TV sets, we just don't want the TV programs that come with them. And he couldn't see that that's a package, right? That the society that gives you the programs he didn't like is also the one that develops the technology, right? And that you don't get to pick and choose those things. I mean, here's what I think it all is. You know, like I say, we evolved in a very different environment. We evolved in kin groups. We have a genetic predisposition to egalitarianism and to kin group solidarity and to a certain coercion. That's how you how you survive as a hunter-gatherer. We've been transplanted as if to a colony on another planet, you know, in a completely different environment. This is the world of skyscrapers and dependence on strangers that you can't see for things that you can only imagine.
What Hayek called the extended order.
Correct. And that feels wrong to us every day because on a genetic, intuitive level, it is wrong. It's not what we evolved for. And so in every generation, you've had people making the Bannon-Sanders argument, right? Something has gone wrong. Why, if everyone is so rich, why don't I feel happier? Why haven't we lost the important things? What about family and friends and faith and all the things that matter more than markets? And that protest, that revolution against modernity can take lots of different forms. It can take the form of revolutionary socialism. It can take the form of fascism. It could take the form of romanticism. I mean, that's basically the romantic movement was that, you know, the whole counter-enlightenment was about that. It could take the form of, you know, the Camus and Sartre and those other idiot existentialists, but it's the same basic thing. I probably going back to Rousseau, I think he's probably the first guy to say there is something wrong with the way I'm feeling about it. And he lived that alienation.
So you see kind of existential angst as a luxury good, essentially.
It is the anguished cry of our inner caveman who just cannot believe or accept that the world is as good as it is. And that's why you and I and the rest of us who get the miracle of market capitalism are never going to be out of work because we have to keep explaining this all over again to people who take prosperity for granted.
That's very comforting. You are going to be speaking at a Reason conference in Guatemala that's held next February. You're going to be talking about socialism. We are in Guatemala. You were born and raised in Peru.
Si, senor.
We're going to be talking about Venezuela a lot. Does the Venezuela example, is that what we need to focus on more to show where this stuff ends up? Or is that too far afield from, saying, if Jeremy Corbyn is elected in the UK, you blink your eyes and you're going to be...
No, I mean, I don't think that's a figure of speech. When I was growing up in Peru, Venezuela was a country that people emigrated to. The idea that it couldn't happen here, which is... dangerously complacent and recurrent theme in both British and American politics, I just don't think is borne out by
the evidence. What is the nature of the failure in Venezuela that led to a rapid decline from the early... I don't know when you want to pick the beginning of the end. Was it in the late 70s when industries were nationalized, when it was Chavez was pardoned and let out of prison? Was it when he won his second election?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to answer that question briefly. Let me make a general point about Latin America that is sometimes missed. The end of the Cold War was as much a liberation for much of Latin America as it was for Eastern Europe. That the pressure that had led to various kinds of dictatorial regimes backed by one side or the other disappeared. And there was a mass democratization in the late 80s and early 90s across the continent. The first wave of non-socialist governments royally screwed things up. They were pro-business rather than pro-market. Mm-hmm. They opened the door to corruption and immobilism and oligarchy. And these are countries where there are inequalities of wealth, where there are racial disparities. And
these people often spoke the language of laissez-faire economics and whatnot.
But they were big government kind of national conservatives, with the exception of Álvaro Uribe in Colombia. He was the one who came closest to a genuine market conservatism. There was a moment around about 2004 when Uribe in South America was the only leader who was not on the populist left, because there was a backlash, understandably. And these various governments of the revolutionary left also failed miserably, failed worse than the pro-Washington governments in the 90s, and particularly failed for the people that they had purported to speak for. And we've now, I think, reached the end of that phase. And so we're back to something a little bit more like normal politics. But in Venezuela, it went further than in other places because the high oil price shielded Chavez from the catastrophic costs of his own policies. So things that would have destroyed another country much more quickly, the centralization of the means of distribution, the imposition of state monopolies, import substitution, all tick every box of how to make a country poorer. The effects of that were for a long time deferred because of these massive inflows from oil, which allowed him not only to buy support at home, but also to buy it abroad, to sponsor Bolivarian revolutions elsewhere. And it was only when that spike in oil came to an end that the consequences of Chavismo caught up with him. And we can see it, the worst refugee crisis in the Western Hemisphere. Yep. I mean, a country that was richer than a lot of Europe in living memory and where there are now deaths through malnutrition. I mean, it is absolutely stunning and a horrible reminder of how quickly things can go wrong.
You have described Miami, Florida, as the greatest Latin American city in the world. Mm. What do you mean by that?
Yeah,
and what is the larger lesson?
The great creation of Fidel Castro was the mercantile and cultural center that is Miami. You know, and what I would say from that is, one of the interesting questions is, why did Latin America not develop in the way that English-speaking America did? Most Central and South American countries became independent kind of, you know, in the 1820s. Most of them copied versions of your constitution. But they didn't import the constitutional stability that North Americans, as we Latinos say, take for granted. They've had, with a few exceptions, but in many cases they've had a series of revolutions and coups and dictatorships, despite, on paper, having similar systems. Why is that? Is it a cultural thing? Is it a, you know, some property in the soil or the gene pool? I always think culture is a kind of cop-out on these occasions. Culture is not some disembodied, numinous entity that kind of floats alongside a country. I mean, it is a product of the institutions of that country. And I think the real difference is that there was an absolute emphasis, first of all, on property rights in the US that had come from England in a way that the equivalent had not happened in Iberian America. Second, that there was a decentralized form of government in North America, that there was the tradition right from the beginning of electing your own mayors and sheriffs and so on in a way that was unthinkable under the Spanish monarchy. And so although the paper rights were the same, the underpinning institutions, the wider cultural institutions were not. But the point of Miami is it shows that, you know, you take people from any of those countries and you put them in a place where property is secure and where you can reasonably invest and expect a return, and they will behave just like any other Americans. I mean, there is no lack of entrepreneurial spirit in Latin America.
So it's the system rather than the individual.
Correct.
Which is a weirdly anti-libertarian, anti-individualist thing to say, isn't it?
Well, you know, put it like this. If you swapped at birth a baby from Wisconsin with one from, you know, Quito, you wouldn't suddenly see some magical change in their lives in the new. They would operate within the context of the institutions and structures of their new country. But I mean, the good news is that means it can be reformed. You know, the trouble is that there is always resistance from established elites to any kind of change that will bust open the system. And that's true whether we're talking about oligarchs in South America who are experts in rent seeking, who have learned how to loot the state through political connections, or at a different level, whether it's the kind of pro-EU elites in a country like mine who have learned how to make a handy living out of the system and don't want any change, right? It's not that the country as a whole is going to be worse off, but their own position will be threatened by any change.
Specifically in Latin America, how much is, you know, one of the arguments of why is Latin America so poor, it's because the United States did things such as, you know, help overthrow democratically elected governments in a wide variety of countries. We closed our eyes, you know, while people were being thrown out of helicopters. Mm. There's also an argument that at least during the Cold War that the Soviets were doing something the same.
Yeah.
How important is that?
It's not. I mean, it is an amazing kind of solipsism. All human beings put themselves at the center of the universe. And we do that politically when we say whatever has happened in the other side of the world is somehow our responsibility. And in fact, the way you phrase the question, which I think is very accurate, is also very telling, that, you know, you overthrew governments and you turned a blind eye. So simultaneously, America is wrong when it intervenes right. and when it doesn't intervene, right? Because everything is always about us. Do you know what? It isn't.
Right.
The reason that, you know, Mexico is in a mess now is because Mexico has a crappy government, which is making bad decisions.
And, I mean, Cuba is a paradigmatic example. There's no question the United States wanted regime change there. They failed at that. Castro, though, and his policies, I mean, this is a country they couldn't trade with the U.S., but they could trade with everyone else. So
I mean, it may be the case that the blockade kept Castro in power longer because it gave him the argument.
I think absolutely. So, yeah.
You know, yeah. But
and it's also true, the United States, and you don't have to go along with this. I'm a United States citizen and a good libertarian. I mean, we did horrible things in Latin America.
Look, yeah. But we should guard against this peculiar self-centeredness that borders almost on kind of mass racism of treating other countries as and people in other countries as though they lacked all agency, as though anything they do is entirely up to us. And they are a kind of inert mass who only ever respond to U.S. policy, right? So the classic example of this is that Venezuela failed because of U.S. sanctions, these miraculous time-traveling U.S. sanctions that were imposed in 2017 and were so powerful that they went back and caused a crisis from 2013 or indeed earlier, right? And by the way, these sanctions were a tiny, targeted, you know, it was a micro-surgery kind of sanction against some of the socialist elites who'd been looting the place. But if you are determined enough in a kind of Corbyn way to see everything in the world as the fault of America and to some extent the fault of Britain and Israel, then you'll be able to find that you'll be able to join the dots, however tenuously, and sustain your prejudice.
So the election is coming up. You want Boris Johnson and the Conservatives to win. Is that going to happen? And if it does happen, what are they going to do?
I can't tell you whether it's going to happen because this is not a Venezuelan election or a Russian election or a Chinese election.
Or an American election, we are, I suppose.
Right.
Yeah.
So we are you know, one of the great
You're
benefits.
The last free place on earth with good election security.
Got, we've still got properly, properly uncertain elections. I mean,
well, but Johnson or the Conservatives are up by something like 9% in the polls. Are they going to win, but not enough?
That's
or?
The thing. I was just going to say. I think if we don't win a plurality of the vote, I will be very, very surprised.
Mm-hmm.
But for boring, complicated reasons, we're fighting on a rather outdated electoral map, which means that you need more votes to elect a Conservative MP than to elect a Labour MP. So if we both get exactly the same vote, Labour wins. Plus, we need to get an absolute majority to form a government because the Scottish Nationals and so on have said that they will not support us. So if we're one short, that results, at least in the short term, in a Corbyn premiership. And that's why I can't say for sure that because we're ahead in the polls. We're
Are you worried at all about what the Conservative Party, though, is offering in England or in Britain? The party has promised to reduce immigration overall. Mm. So that, you know, which, again, I understand your argument and the libertarian or liberal argument to get out of Brexit, but there were a lot of people who seemed to be anti-immigrant. It's talking about throwing billions of new pounds at national health. Is the Conservative Party really the party of limited government?
Yeah, and limited government, definitely. Is it the kind of libertarian party that you and I would draw up from first principles?
Mm-hmm.
No, and it never will be, and nor will any other party, right? I mean, or rather any party that is, like the Libertarian Party here, is going to be limited to kind of 3% in any election. So Boris is a
perfect leader.
He's a
human without any problems, any shortcomings.
He is human, and therefore he is not perfect. And his conservatism is much more middle of the road on economics. But I'd make two points. First of all, this is an emergency. So against an unapologetically Marxist leader who backed the other side during the Cold War, I mean, that's how serious it is. In that situation, every libertarian, every conservative, every Christian Democrat, every moderate centrist, indeed every social democrat should rally behind the guy who's going to stop the Marxists. Second, I've known Boris for a long time. He is one of the cleverest people I've ever come across, maybe the cleverest I've worked with. And he gets that money doesn't grow on trees. He understands that free enterprise is necessary to growth and prosperity. And he gets that in a democracy, you can considerably tilt the balance back towards the private sector without needing to make any cuts. Indeed, while making increases, targeted increases in public spending, provided that you get the overall monetary and fiscal framework right, so that you're allowing the private sector to grow faster than the public sector. And this is actually what Margaret Thatcher did. Every year that she was in office, contrary to almost universal belief, public spending slightly grew, but the private sector grew a lot faster.
You've got kids. You mentioned your 3.5-year-old son. Are you confident that they'll live in a freer, fairer, you know, richer, better world than we're in now?
Richer and better, I think, almost certainly. And anyone who'd made that prediction at any time in the last 300 years would have been laughed at and would have been right. You know, I don't expect that. I mean, you know, Jeremy Corbyn is trying to mandate a 4-day week with state coercion. I suspect my kids will be working far shorter hours, living far better than we can imagine, just as we are compared to our grandparents. You know, the thing that worries me, because I don't want to be completely, I don't want just want to do the whole sort of, you know, Norberg, Ridley, Pinker, everything is getting better forever and ever, amen. There is one thing that really worries me, and it is the pre-Enlightenment thinking that is creeping into not just higher education, but secondary education as well now. You know, I was saying earlier, socialism chimes with our kind of Paleolithic instincts, right? We're not a libertarian species by nature. We've had to learn that. We've had to learn it empirically. We've had to see that it works better. And we've had to teach it, right? That lovely line that Hannah Arendt once used, that in every generation, the West is invaded by barbarians. We call them children, right? In other words, you and I come into the world pretty much with the same equipment that we would have done 50,000 years ago. The reason that we live in comfort rather than the way we did 50,000 years ago is because of learned institutions that are transmitted. And for a long time, that was the primary function of education. It was to teach people that some of the rules of thumb and heuristics that they were born with were no longer apt in the modern world. And in particular, to teach them the value of personal responsibility. Right. So I would say the real essence of modernity, the basis of the post-Enlightenment society, is the move away from caste and status and birth and tradition towards the idea that you and I can make a contract and it's no one else's business. That, like I said, we're not born thinking that that's logical. We have to be taught why that works. And what really alarms me when I now look at universities and high schools is that not only are we not teaching that, we are increasingly teaching the opposite. Instead of the basically counter-cyclical idea that, you know, you're not defined by ancestry and physiognomy, that you're defined by you and the choices you make and the actions that you take, we're actually teaching pro-cyclically. We're saying, oh, no, no, in fact, everyone is defined by the fact that they're black or women or gay or whatever. And I think actually a lot of conservatives get the tone of their attack on identity politics wrong. They either laugh at it and, you know, how ridiculous political correctness gone mad, or they say, you know, this is sort of appalling, oppressive, and so on. I actually think it's much more serious. I think we are reverting to a pre-modern way of thinking. And in a multi-ethnic society like this one, or indeed like Britain, once you go down that road of defining people by ancestry, you make an open society almost impossible.
On that cheery note, we will leave it there. We have been talking with Daniel Hannan, a member of the European Parliament, at least for a little while longer, and one of the architects of Brexit. Thank you so much for talking.
Thank you, Nick.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. I've been Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this show and Reason's other podcasts by going to reason.com/podcasts. Thanks for listening.